Committee on Human Services on May 8, 2009, and I open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 200. Keeley.
Senate Bill 200 declares homelessness a detriment to individuals, families, and communities and establishes a state policy regarding homelessness that requires the Department of Human Services and the Housing and Community Services Department to work together to encourage innovation and create a comprehensive and collaborative support system and housing resources required to end and prevent homelessness.
Thank you, Keeley. So I think we have some people who would like to speak with us about that. We have Bill Hall, Roberto Franco, John, is it Alton?
Atten.
Okay, let's start with those three people, and then we'll have here some others. Thanks for coming today.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Might I welcome my county commissioner?
Absolutely, please do.
Bill Hall, who stepped into my seat when I came over here. So I've been following his activities very closely. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. And thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I am Bill Hall. In addition to being a Lincoln County Commissioner, I serve as Vice Chair of the Oregon Ending Homelessness Advisory Committee, or as we fondly call it, the EHAC. And today I'm asking you to join your Senate colleagues in supporting Senate Bill 200, which they approved unanimously. This bill has no funding directly associated with it. However, it's not all about new resources, but also how we could use what we currently have in a different framework as SB 200 proposes. Furthermore, we have the opportunity to apply the current funding available through the federal government, which is targeted for homeless prevention and rapid rehousing of homeless persons within this new framework. Other opportunities to consider include new resources that will be available thanks to your action earlier in this session to approve the document recording fee. Existing state resources available to spend on homelessness and affordable housing. It's important that we use our available resources as effectively as possible, and this bill sets the state of Oregon on a path to accomplish exactly that. In Lincoln County, I chaired the committee that developed our local homeless plan, and I also co-wrote that document. The things I learned at the local level turned out to be true at the state level as well. There has been too much siloing of services and a lack of effective communication and collaboration to address the problem of homelessness. I think we've accomplished some remarkable things in Lincoln County in the year and a half since we began implementing our plan. That's included the creation of 18 units of permanent supportive housing with Housing Plus funds that you approved in 2007, two Project Homeless Connect events, an expanded rent assistance program, establishment of a community land trust, and the launch of a runaway and homeless youth initiative. Now, in part, this has involved attracting new resources, but we've also found it's just as important to get the most out of what we already have. I have been amazed in both Newport and Salem to be involved in discussions about homelessness and find that the people sitting around the table had never been there at the same time before. Public and private partners need to work together collaboratively. We're doing it in Lincoln County, and we're starting to do it here in Salem, but we need to make sure that we continue on this path. I am also pleased that SB 200 establishes permanent supportive housing as the state's preferred response to homelessness. Permanent supportive housing was certified as an evidence-based practice earlier this year. It's been documented to be the most effective response to homelessness by far. Warming shelters and soup kitchens can and do save lives, but they don't get to the long-term roots of the problem. We need a new mindset and a commitment to effective solutions if we are ever going to truly address what Philip Mangano, the director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, calls the moral outrage of homelessness. SB 200 puts the state of Oregon on the path to accomplish this great task. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. We're going to hear from the other speakers, and then we'll open up to questions. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee.
I'm Roberto Franco, Director's Office Liaison at the Oregon Housing Community Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 200. If you allow me a minute or so to put the bill in context and the background that why it is important for the state. Between 2007 and 2008, our departments and the many partners that work with us counted 11% more homeless people between that period of time, 2007 and 2008. In real numbers, in 2008, 12,529 people compared to 11,292 in 2007. In 2009, according to our preliminary results, there is a 36% increase from 2008. And in real numbers, that's about 17,000 or over 17,000. We estimate that that number is going to remain steady for at least for the interim period of time, given the economic recession that many communities are going through. From the 2008, just a few highlights in the results. 51% of Oregon's homeless were people in one or two parent families with children. The one night count also identified 20% of those counted were children age 11 or younger. 12% of the households that were identified sought services but could not find them or they were thrown away. Shelters were full or other services are not available to them. 23% of the households counted lived on the streets without support or without assistance. Of those counted, many of them, as we said here, 5,641 people said that they needed services as well. Some of them needed treatment for mental health, substance abuse. Some had were affected by domestic violence, and others had physical disability. So what do these numbers mean for us? What do they represent for us? And I think homelessness does create personal costs. It is expensive. It does create costs at the human and personal level because it's often compounded by other circumstances such as disabilities, mental illness, substance abuse, traumatic life experiences, combat war experiences, domestic violence. All of that also creates a cost, personal and human and societal, and that affects us all as a society as well. Shelters, emergency rooms, visits, the time, the processing in jail, putting people in jail sometimes because the only place they can get a shelter or some food it's in prison. All of that is expensive, and we see that homelessness a lot of times cut lives short, and it cuts and deprives us opportunities to have prosperous and healthy communities. And so you may ask, so what are we doing? What's going? Who's working? Who's doing something about it? I think that for the last 15, 20 years, our response has been really let's fix it with temporary solutions, meaning we've utilized our shelter systems as the long-term solution. And we often graduate people from shelter, transitional housing, treatment, finally to a permanent housing, as if it's a process of graduating people into something more permanent. Now, in 2006, Governor Kulongoski established the Council on Ending Homelessness, as Mr. Hall referred to it, on which he co-chairs. And it brings state and local representatives and agencies to create different ways of and solutions for ending and preventing homelessness. Through the council, now the state has a 10-year plan, which I believe you have a copy of, and it lays out the strategies that we believe and that we've researched that can really prevent and end homelessness. You may say, well, do we end it in 10 years? Probably not, because there is a lot in homelessness. It's a complicated circumstance. But we truly believe that we could end it for a child, we could end it for a family, we could end it for a whole household. And that in itself is a big accomplishment. The plan the state plan on ending homelessness again calls for housing and permanent housing as a one of the best solutions. It calls for coupling services with housing, and it calls for us a different framework in providing services where we focus on the need of the people, not so much on the needs of an agency or the needs of the service providers. The education, schooling, mental health, treatment, recovery, and many other things that we aspire as human beings often is not possible without a permanent house or a permanent home. We often say that talk to a child about homework. It's contradictory when you said do your work at home or homework when there is no home where to do it. And the solution that we found is that permanent home stability really helps, and we've seen that in many communities. Many Oregon communities and counties also have their 10-year plan, and the focus on all of those plans is also permanent housing. It doesn't ignore the that now and then we need to address emergency situations. Sometimes a family or an individual may just need a couple of days to get back on its feet. But there's a lot of people that need more than that transitional, more than 2 days. Oftentimes, it takes more than 30 days, more than a year to get back on your feet. Now, so what does the bill do? It really does recognize as a state that homelessness is a serious problem and that it needs a more constant and focused attention. Just as we have a focused attention and hunger, and they do go together, hunger and homelessness. Oftentimes people will go without paying the rent in order to have some food or vice versa. They'll go hungry in order to pay the rent because they don't want to be evicted. So the bill calls that attention. This is our stand as a state on homelessness. Specifically, it calls for, again, for a more coordinated approach, as Mr. Hall referenced, that we often work in silos. The left hand on the services sometimes doesn't know what the right hand on the housing does, and vice versa. And it focuses on permanent housing rather than on temporary solutions. It does call for a better collaboration, again, between the between local, county, state, and federal agencies to provide more effective services so that people don't have to jump from agency to agency or from place to place to get the services that they need, that at least one or two agencies can work together. We also understand that not just one single agency can help one homeless individual. It's going to take a lot more than that. It'll take employment, it'll take education, it'll take public health, it'll take oftentimes the police department, the sheriff department, all of that. It requires more than just one agency to do that. And finally, it calls for measurable outcomes, and the big measurable outcome is the housing stability. That once you put people in permanent housing, that closes the door into homelessness, that they don't go back through the back door and back into homelessness again. And the recognition that homelessness and homeless people are individuals with their unique experiences, and that they also have their strengths, and that they also need, again, an individualized approach rather than trying to put them in a box. They are people. They are different, each one of them. As Mr. Hall also referenced, the bill itself does not ask for more resources, but it does entail that we need to look at how differently we should use our current resources so that, again, we could provide more effective services. A more efficient and effective delivery of services, in the long run, it reduces or at least avoid costs across many of the systems or services. If we put people in permanent housing with services, it's a lot cheaper than booking them in jail, for example. It's a lot cheaper than them using the emergency rooms as their primary health care service. Senate Bill 200, again, creates that framework. It guides and gives different directions for policymakers and the bigger service providers. Oregon Housing and Community Services and the Department of Human Services, along with the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness, they are one of the major players that will implement this policy. That will also give room to other players in the communities and at the state level. And finally, Senate Bill 200 gives Oregon and Oregon communities with plans that push to now be excellent, not just have excellent plans, but also have an excellence in the service delivery to adults, homeless children, and homeless families. And so I thank you for the time and for letting me represent Oregon Housing. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. Before I proceed with my formal testimony, I'm going to add a comment that you heard both Roberto and Mr. Hall refer to the silos that they experienced operating in, and Mr. Hall said that his experience sitting down with the representatives of various agencies was the first time they had all been at the same table, and I want to add the comment that as a consumer, navigating that was an absolute nightmare if the agency representatives themselves aren't even sure who each other are and what they do.
You didn't identify yourself.
You're right. That was because it's part of the formal testimony. With that, my name is John Atten. I am a recovering heroin addict and a survivor of homelessness. I support Senate Bill 200 because this will bring to Oregon the potential to deliver statewide a model of coordinated housing and services similar to that which has served me and thousands of others so effectively. There are many in the recovering community who will offer the wisdom that recovery is a process, not an event. So it is with addiction, and so it is with homelessness. In the course of a 15-year addiction to heroin, I've had many attempts at treatment for the judge, for my girlfriend, for my family, for everybody but myself. In all of these cases, I was sent back to where I started, to the same friends, the same family, and the same situations. You know, so there was no net change in my life. Go to treatment, come back, get put back where I was. There came a point at which I no longer had the resources to sustain a normal existence. I was homeless, I had lost my friends and my family, my job, and any sense of the integrity with which I was raised. I wanted desperately to stop, but I didn't know how. Where I came from, to get on methadone required a wait of 6 to 8 weeks. To enter detox, I had to somehow show that I would have a treatment bed when I got out. To get a treatment bed required insurance, and there was a wait list for that, too. To get even the basic state health plan was another 6 to 8 week wait and several appointments and reams of paperwork, and they wanted to mail me the information. I was homeless. I was unable to manage this level of complexity in order to get help. In desperation, I called Hooper Detox in Portland. I described my situation and asked if I could be there at 7:30 the next morning. After 12 days of acute withdrawal, I was enrolled immediately in treatment and in the Central City Concern Recovery Mentor Program. I was given the key to a room in the old Danmore building where I stayed during 90-plus days of treatment. The Danmore provided a clean and sober community of people who shared a common purpose, to live again and to recover. The mentor program offered a guide who had been there before and would hold me accountable as I negotiated the trials of early recovery. From there, I was enrolled in CCC's WorkSource program, where I was given the tools to leverage my existing work skills into the start of a new career. That was 5.5 years ago. Today, I am the Occupancy and Compliance Manager for all of Central City Concern's housing, totaling over 1,300 affordable units. In this capacity, I work extensively with Oregon Housing and Community Services to ensure the effective delivery of CCC's housing model to some of the most challenging and hardest to house populations in Portland. There are thousands who have benefited from this integrated system of housing and services in the Portland metro area. However, there are thousands more who may not even know yet that they want to get out. From a personal and professional perspective, my goal is to ensure that the same opportunity so graciously afforded me is available to the next person who so desperately needs our help. I present my story today in order that you might see what can be accomplished by pairing housing with a coordinated continuum of services. For most like me, there usually develops a window in which the horror and misery of where we find ourselves overshadows the fear of the unknown, the fear of asking for help, and the fear of facing the wreckage we have created. But ultimately, at a moment when I became willing, the availability of treatment, employment services, and safe, supportive housing were key to becoming who I am today. I'm here as a concerned citizen, a registered voter, and a member of the recovering community. But most important to me, I represent the person who can't be here today because the underlying cause of their homelessness has not yet been addressed. My name is John Atten. I put the needle in my vein for the last time on October 31st, 2003. I've been clean for 2,013 days due to the efforts of people such as yourselves and others who believe that my addiction and my homelessness were not permanent conditions. I appreciate your time today and all the good works you do, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Atten. We're very happy to have you here today, happy to see you healthy and clean.
Me too.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. Sure, that sounds like hard work. Thank you. Any questions of anyone in this panel? Well, you've done a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming
Madam
today.
Chair?
Yes. Oh, what? Now, wait a minute.
Well, no, I'm actually going to let you off the hook, but thank you for just a moment. The question I was going to ask you is, what does this bill do? Because I know it doesn't have any money in it, and I know that we all are concerned about these issues, and I'm struggling with a lot of the legislation that we have been forced to pass because we don't have any money, so we just put together another plan to talk about it some more. But this is a very powerful panel. And Mr. Atten, I want to tell you that you brought it together for me, in my mind, with all due respect to the other panel members whom I have a great deal of respect for. I think your comment that if our agencies and our programs haven't sat down and talked to each other and don't know what each other are doing, how on earth can we expect the person in a challenge situation to go through the nightmare of what that presents to the consumer? And to me, that answered what this bill does. So I just wanted you to know that it wasn't that we don't have any questions. It was actually the power of this panel that answered my questions.
Thank you, Representative. Very nicely said. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now we have Susan, is it Van?
No, I did it.
And Donna? Bolt?
That's good.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you.
Just be sure and identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Ban. I am the executive director of a private nonprofit in Lane County, Oregon. That agency has been providing services addressing the issues of homelessness since 1970. I was a member of EHAC, as we commonly call it, and also worked in Lane County on the 10-year plan in Lane County that also is searching locally to provide the coordination of services so that we can take the resources we have and apply them more effectively and more efficiently. My agency serves families with children who are situationally homeless due to a one-time family crisis. We also serve adults with psychiatric disabilities who have been chronically homeless on the streets for months and years. Our agency will provide shelter and support to over 1,500 individuals this year who have been homeless or are at risk of homelessness. We provide emergency, transitional, and long-term supported housing, the kind of support services that are described in SB 200. I've been working in this field over 20 years, and during that entire time, our community shelters have worked from a waiting list that has left families homeless and on the streets waiting for an available unit 2 months or more. Every year, the number of impoverished households in our community has grown, and as the percentage of families in poverty has increased, the cost of housing and utilities in our community has increased as well. There are ever-growing pressures on low-income households and ever-dwindling resources to create safety and resilience. And as you well know, Lane County right now has 14% unemployment, and we are looking at a growing number of households that are losing housing, looking at foreclosure, and getting on our waiting lists for services that are very restricted. Homelessness has severe and negative repercussions for those who experience it. Studies have shown for 20 years or more that children experiencing homelessness demonstrate the very same characteristics of those children who have experienced abuse or neglect. Often they lose developmental strides that they have gained. Always they experience some degree of trauma that will accompany them the rest of their lives. I sat in a room with my Donna Butera, who's a homeless liaison for the Bethel School District. A couple of years ago, we were meeting with a granting agency that was looking at our children's program. And Donna was very compelling in describing the fact that the teachers at Bethel, which is a somewhat small district, could actually try, and they know their families very well, could actually see when a family went into crisis, could see when that family was homeless because of the way the children became sort of disorganized, behavior problems, coming to school unkempt, you know, and then they could also see when they finally got into shelter. And usually that was after a 2 to 3 month wait, but she said the teachers would breathe a sigh of relief when they were finally in shelter because the kids were showing up awake, they were fed, they were bathed, they were ready to kind of focus back on doing homework. But for many of those homeless families, that cycle of homelessness 2 or 3 or 4 times, and I know Donna knows this too, really can put children back grade levels and really interfere with their developmental growth. Our programs also understand the debilitating effects of homelessness on adults, and especially those adults with disabilities that complicate their lives. Without shelter, it is very difficult, challenging to get organized to do the most basic of things, eating well, daily hygiene, keeping appointments, taking medications. Once in shelter, once in housing, it is amazing to see how people's lives can at last settle into a predictable and sustainable order, one that promotes recovery, resilience, and success. We just had a young man recently who had a normal childhood, grew up, was a foreman in the timber industry, and at age 28 had a first major break of a psychiatric disability that so disorganized his life that he was on the streets for 3 or 4 years before moving into one of our shelters that works with chronically homeless. Just last week, we worked with him for a little bit over a year, and just last week, he was able to move into permanent supportive housing that is the kind of affordable housing programs that SB 200 highlights. He has a part-time job. He's in care. He will be fine. He has the rest of his life to look forward to living a normal and resilient life in the community. It would not have happened without services, shelter services, emergency transitional long-term support services in the community, and coordination of care. We, as a state and as a nation, do have some great tools in our toolbox for addressing homelessness. There are national models that have been applied effectively in our state and elsewhere that really work. We have begun to see the tremendous impact of programs like Housing First or Homelessness Prevention right here in Oregon. Unfortunately, these effective models of care are limited and scattered. Homelessness cuts across all of the regions of the state and takes on the flavor of rural, frontier, urban, and suburban landscapes. We need a well-coordinated and best practice approach that is statewide. So SB 200 establishes the policy and framework for the state to respond more effectively to preventing and ending homelessness. It supports local efforts like the 10-year plan in Lane County to focus on strategies and solutions that do have demonstrated effectiveness and do provide permanent solutions for the individuals served. So homelessness is a serious problem in Oregon. I know that you understand that. It does require, at long last, a focused and organized response so that we are most effective with the limited resources we have. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Susan.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Quick question. Thank you. Are there any studies? Thought just crossed my mind when you were talking about the ex-logger that had the mm-hmm. emotional break. Mm-hmm. Are there any studies that you know of with the homeless community and the mental health community that tries to direct the dire situation that people are in with the policies that are being made at the state level?
Through the mental health division, what I will say, I don't know the direct answer to that. What I do know, with my mental health hat on for a minute and not my housing hat on, is that what we are trying to do internationally, it's some of the studies that have happened in New Zealand that have translated to Maine that are now having some local application in Oregon because of the mental health division, is identify first break earlier and do more prevention programs so that we don't have the experience of people going through that just traumatic kind of disruption in their lives and having to go to homelessness to get back into a system of care. So, trying to identify earlier and earlier indicators that then prevent the whole cycle. So I am aware that we actually have some real activity going on in that area. The kinds of research that has happened nationally around housing first, you go to the SAMHSA website, the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency website, many cities are reporting that by taking chronically homeless folks and getting them into housing that actually really works, that it cuts their impact on jails, on public safety, on emergency departments, on psychiatric units. In fact, housing seems to be the key that allows all the other pieces to get organized so that the person can begin a recovery, a path toward recovery and success. It used to be that in our old model, we used to require, well, get clean first, then we'll get you into housing. That doesn't work. Get you into housing, and then we'll start putting the resources around you that can actually help sustainability, resilience, recovery, and it does work. We see it working all the time. It's amazing.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a comment. I guess I'm new enough that I was sitting here listening, and it dawned on me about the policies that we can set. And what is the causal effect of those policies 1 or 2 years or so down the line? And then we come back and meet here to set different policy to assist the people that maybe some of our policy hurt 2 years earlier. Anyway, just deep thoughts, ma'am.
Good, I love your deep thoughts. Thank you, Representative Huffman. Okay, Dana?
My name is Donna Bolt.
Donna,
from,
sorry.
That's okay. From the Oregon Department of Education. I've been a state coordinator for the education of homeless children and youth for a couple of decades now. Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee for listening to this testimony. I'm going to keep mine brief, but I want to wrap it up, too, by answering some of the questions and also giving you a little vision of what happens to young children when they endure homelessness and kind of support some of what Susan was saying on the adult side with some things that I've observed myself. So the one thing that this bill does, we've been working as the Governor's Advisory Committee on Ending Homelessness for a couple of years now, and Susan and I and Bill and Roberto have been members. I think the four of us and a couple of other people were very, very urgent in our insistence that children, families, and youth be included in this concept of ending homelessness. There were models coming down from the national government that suggested that if we limited it to chronic adult single individuals who had dual diagnosis in mental health and alcoholism and whatever, that those would be the primary focus for housing. And there are a lot of us who disagreed with that thought we needed a more big-picture response and something that would hit all different ages and types and groups of homeless people. And so with that in mind, and the members of the committee wanted to bring in the leadership of the folks that work on the Hunger Council with the folks that work on the homeless end of it, and have all of our agencies talking together at the state level at the same pages, at the same places, under this umbrella agency called the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness. So SB 200 actually creates that umbrella agent task force group advisory committee that are the spokespeople for the various state agencies. Once we can get together and talk about this stuff and the various duplications in the system and the various barriers to getting in one door and out another, then we can model that kind of communication with the county level. We can model that at the community level. We can talk to people about how, well, we've resolved this issue between education and child welfare. And so here's what we can talk to you at the county level about how you need to integrate your services with the school districts, with your services with foster care and safety supports from child welfare. Things like that are examples. But anyway, the proposal is to have better continuum of services just through the interaction at the state level that we can, you know, merge our silos statewide and then have that mirrored at the county and community level. And we've already seen examples of where this is working very well. And I will cite Commissioner Hall's county as being one of the leaders in getting this melting of ideas and resources and just enthusiasm together in his county. So he knows wherever I speak, I think. Number three. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, last year, and I'll talk a little bit about the children. Last year, and every year, we count at the school district level the number of enrolled students who are homeless, who meet the eligibility criteria of homelessness. And we've watched these numbers go up from 6,000 in the year that I started to, they're getting close to 17,000. And I think we're going to see a huge spike next year because of the foreclosure crisis, the job losses, all of the poverty that we've seen. I've had liaisons calling me. There's 197 liaisons representing 197 school districts in our state. And so I've had a lot of them calling me saying, wow, we've had the same numbers in November that we had at the end of the year last year. This is incredible what's happening with this foreclosure crisis. And it's shown up with a lot of people, families and unaccompanied minors who have never been homeless before. Kids who've been kicked out of their homes at 16 because their parents couldn't afford to keep them, left on the doorstep of the outreach center that connects with the school because they know that child or that youth will be assisted by this agency because they help everybody in the community. And so we've seen things like that happen. We've seen people turn resentful at the idea that, they lost the family farm, but don't dare call us homeless because we're not those people under the bridges. We're proud people, and we're not like, you know, there's different levels of understanding and stigmatism around that whole homeless concept that itself creates a barrier. 99 school districts out of that 197 had more than 20 children enrolled who met the eligibility criteria of homeless last year. That's an 07-08 school year. And that's the area that we're going to see a spike in. Plus, all of those rural districts, they may have had 18 kids. They may have had 17. They may have had all the way down to 3 kids or 1 or 2. We had about 30 districts with zeros. But it could be that they didn't get into the forest. They would be small districts. You could have families anywhere. I've traveled and visited many, many communities and had the liaison take me into the woods to see the trailer park where her kids were living, to see the migrant camp that was, some of the worst kinds of poverty exists where people don't have running water or electricity and they're relying on donations. And there was this one house we saw with a broken window that had a child's teddy bear stuffed in the hole to keep the wind out. And this is probably a donated teddy bear or something like that because there were a lot of unused tricycles around and bicycles, just lots and lots of stuff they couldn't really use as homeless people. What they needed was home, a place to stay that they could call their own. When I first started this job, I was appalled by a case that I read that spoke about two kids in California, fortunately not Oregon. But anyway, they were living in a car for about 2 years, and they had grown up. There were two boys, and they were very close in age. And the younger one would sit on his knees on the back seat of the car and play cards or trucks or, you know, toys with the older one, who would be sitting on the edge of the doorway. And they played like that for years. And when they finally got into a shelter, what did they do? But they went to a couch, and the little one got up onto the couch, onto his knees, and the older one sat down beside the couch, and they played in exactly the same physical format or arrangement that they had been when they were in the car. It took a long time for them to, like, discover space. It was really interesting. Another example that I heard of and actually visited the shelter where it occurred, tiny baby. It had just been born to a homeless mother. Mother's living at the shelter, and back in those days, we didn't have the programs and the services within the shelters that would have given her parental education, whatever. Back 20 years ago, she was smoking in front of the TV set with a lot of other people, and the baby was in the nursery, swaddled up with blankets. Tiny baby like this, and stayed there for about 8 months. Can you imagine the developmental delays, the lack of motor skills that kid had when they finally found housing for the mom and opened up that swaddling and found a baby that couldn't use his arms or his legs very much. He wasn't kicking and crawling and stuff like he used to because he had been left in a crib for so long. And now we have shelters that do have that kind of parent education and do have the resources and knowledge not to let that kind of thing happen again. The third little story I'm going to tell, and this is right from Eugene, a school that didn't even exist anymore, Whittaker Elementary, one of the highest poverty schools with the highest turnover rate. Over 100% of the kids turned over every year. I was told about a six-year-old in first grade who was still in diapers. Mom had never gotten around to training her. Imagine what that teacher had to do in order not only to teach this child, but to also take care of her hygiene. And this is with a room full of 35 other little kids at the same time. I mean, the time bombs that homelessness brings to the education system in the form of young children that are not yet ready to learn is something that I have always found really appalling. And
Anna, I'm going to need you to wrap up.
I'm sorry.
We've got two more bills.
Very sorry. Okay, well, on your sheet, there's numbers of the homeless count from last year for your various communities that I thought might be interesting. But again, thanks for your time, and thanks for supporting this initiative.
Thank you, Donna. Any quick questions? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you guys for your testimony and your passion for what you do. What an important thing it is you do for the communities that we all represent. I hope Senate Bill 200 will look at not just coordinating those agencies and dealing with homelessness after the fact. I hope it'll take an opportunity to have somebody look at some of the causes. And you talked about your unemployment rate in your area. In my area, it's almost 19%.
Right.
So I got to imagine that contributes to some level of homelessness. And I know for a fact in my area, some of the extreme environmental agenda, some of the lack of timber management has caused these problems. So we talk about cause and effect. We need to be aware of what we do and how it affects people's opportunities to have a job and to have a home and to have hope. So thank you for what you do, and I hope we all pay attention to what we do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank everybody in the room who's testified and all that for what they do. The one recurring theme I hear throughout all the testimony is prevention, and that's very important, and that's something that I've been working on now for, I figured it out, I don't even want to say how many years, but it's 41 total. And
congratulations.
Thanks.
And when she was three,
one of the things that caught my attention a few years ago here at a very early morning meeting with Representative Butler, with Jean Lassiter, she's working with homeless youth. This seemed to be a population of runaway and homeless youth that were kind of the throwaway kids, if you will, and forgotten kids. And these were the kids who, if they had a problem, and a lot of them who we know about were sexually abused. And so they're not little kids. They didn't get the attention little kids get to take out to go to foster care. They were placed in foster care and took off from there. But I wanted to let you all know there is a lot of research going on, and it's good. In Mr. Franco's testimony, he points out that 88% of homeless people that are identified have some sort of substance abuse problem, so I think we need to be aware of that with our policy on treatment, et cetera. But one of the other populations that we don't always catch are veterans, and we're going to have a lot of returning veterans with a lot of very serious traumatic issues as they get back in. And I live in a rural area, and I don't know because I've never been homeless, but I would imagine I would rather be homeless in a rural area than in a city, to tell you the truth, because of the a little more ease of living out. I like to camp, so I can do that. But the last thing I wanted to point out to everybody, I think it's May 19th, there's a rally here at the Capitol. Runaway and homeless youth are having a whole day here. They start at 9 o'clock in room 350, and they'll be here in the building that day and trying to raise awareness again of this issue and hope that they can. They've done some great things. Last session we gave them $1 million for their program, and they gave out I think 20 grants, and they're doing great things, and it's exponentially helping so many more people. But this influx of homelessness that we're seeing because of the economy or whatever reasons, there are people in, and I notice 85 people in my or 86 in my area in Seaside. We are seeing people coming for help at our Department of Human Services who are not people you would normally associate with being down on their luck. And so I think that we all need to be aware of that and what policy we do make here, and that we don't increase those hardships that make people tip over the edge and then fall into that problem and losing their homes.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much for coming to testify, and all of you who did come to testify today. We really appreciate it. And with that, we'll be closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 2000, open up the Senate Bill 221A. Healy?
Senate Bill 220A authorizes the Attorney General to administer Federal Violence Against Women Act grants and any other state or federal grant related to service for victims of violent crimes, property crimes, and crimes involving fraud and deception.
Great. And we have one person signed up. Cynthia Stinson? Hi, Cynthia. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 220A. I'll make this short and sweet. This is a technical cleanup bill. When we were doing grant agreements for our grantees last spring, we realized that we didn't have clear statutory authority for the Violence Against Women Act grants that we had received from Oregon State Police in 2007. So the legislature had made the move from Oregon State Police to DOJ, but in our statutes we didn't have anything clear to refer back to. So this bill changes that and makes clear that we have authority to administer ongoing federal grants to benefit victims of crime, and it also expands the language so that we could, if we were to have another opportunity to access another ongoing grant from the federal government, we wouldn't have to go in and change our statutes again. I would note that this doesn't in any way circumvent or trump the requirement that we have to come to the legislature and ask for permission to even apply for the grants and to accept the money when we get it. So this is really just so we can refer back legally in our grant agreements. I will note, in the summary for the bill, it also says that it modifies the purpose for which the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund may be used, and that really isn't accurate. The other technical fix in this bill is that In 2001, when the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund was created, the VAWA money, Violence Against Women Act money, was at Oregon State Police. And as I said before, it moved to our office in 2007. So as long as we were cleaning up part of the statute, we thought we would eliminate the requirement to coordinate with OSP. We're happy to still coordinate and collaborate with OSP, but we don't need to do it for the purposes of sharing funding for domestic and sexual violence services. We're doing pretty well collaborating with ourselves right now. So that's really all the bill does.
Thank you, Cynthia. Any questions of this witness?
I have a question, and I've always had a problem. This has been really frustrating to me. I've always had a problem with the fact that, and not just your agency, but all agencies have to come to us for permission to apply for a grant, and in some cases, when they get the grant, permission to spend it on that purpose. I've seen it more often, I suppose, in natural resource areas. One time, the state had, there was a program or project or whatever, received state federal funding. It was the number two grant in the whole country for this purpose. It was a model that everyone was trying to, they wanted to get it implemented so they could model after it. It was a huge amount of money, and it just, all we needed here was permission, and just by the luck of the draw, when it got to Ways and Means, it was defeated because one member thought that we shouldn't be spending federal dollars like that. And I have a problem with that. I'm not sure what we can do about it, but
probably nothing in this committee.
But it's just, I just had the bump. Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Ms. Benson? Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 22A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 275A.
Senate Bill 275 allows individuals with a serious mental illness to apply for medical assistance between 90 and 120 days prior to their release from a public institution and to receive assistance on release if they're found to be eligible.
Welcome, ladies.
Good morning. I'm Deanna Hartwig. Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Deanna Hartwig. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. And I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 275A. This bill allows an individual with a serious mental illness to apply for medical assistance between 90 and 120 days prior to their release from prison. This bill provides the opportunity for any severely mentally ill individual to make application and provides the department adequate time to determine eligibility before the release date. It's also consistent with our current partnership with the Department of Corrections that has resulted in about 148 individuals with severe mental illness being determined eligible for Medicaid prior to their release. In the Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee, we requested this amendment so it more closely follows the actual practice we have with the Department of Correction. We do need the 90 to 120 days in order to adequately have time to make the determination for disability to give them the Medicaid. Because the number of individuals who would apply for Medicaid prior to release is relatively small, and we have the process in place to handle these applications, there's no fiscal impact on the department at this time.
Thank you, Deanna. I think we'll hear from the other person, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Stewart. I'm the administrator of the Transition and Release Unit with the Department of Corrections. I think Ms. Hartwig really summarized the bill very nicely, so my testimony will be brief and simply say that the Department of Corrections supports this bill. We urge your support of the bill. This bill puts the process into place that will provide high-need medical, mental health inmates with the services that they need immediately upon release from incarceration. I was also asked by the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors to mention that they support this bill as well and urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was reading through the fiscal analysis that had been provided in connection with this bill, and I was confused by a line at the end of it that says, currently persons with mental illness residing in public institutions already may apply for medical assistance between 90 and 100 days, et cetera. So I'm trying to understand, does that mean from other sorts of public institutions, but that the Department of Correction clients don't have that authority at that point? At this point, is that the reason for this bill?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, we have a practice in place that allows inmates between 90 and 120 days before release to make application. We are doing that in conjunction with the Department of Corrections because we thought it was a good thing to do.
Right.
This bill would actually make it quite clear that that's a process that the state wants to have occur. Some of you might remember Senate Bill 913. That was a bill that allowed the department to suspend Medicaid for up to 12 months if an individual was incarcerated. Part of that time, we would close their Medicaid case, and they would have to reapply upon release. The way we handle that now and with this bill, it makes it much easier for individuals with severe mental illness to have that medical card, which will allow them continued access to their medications and the opportunity to see physicians if we continue to do this. So I'm not sure that answers your question totally.
I'll try. So essentially this bill will codify existing practice, which, by the way, I completely support. It's obvious that when people try to reintegrate, they need to be able to continue their medications. But is that basically what I'm hearing then? Is this sort of codifies what we're trying to do?
Yeah, Chair, Representative. What the practice is in place right now and what we are hoping is that it just gets put into statute so that when we are no longer with the agencies, it will still be prioritized.
Okay, thank you.
And will still happen.
Any further questions? Deanna, could you talk a little bit about, well, there's only two new people here. Explain just briefly what happened before the previous Senate bill was passed that allowed us to continue their medical coverage.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'll give my perspective, and Heidi might want to give hers. When a person is incarcerated, obviously they're not eligible for any federal Medicaid assistance. And the practice at that time was, if you're incarcerated or in jail for more than 30 days, we're going to close your case in our local senior people with disabilities and area agency on aging local offices. So upon release, you'd have to go back to the local office, fill out an application, go through that process again to get your medical card. This is a much more efficient way of making sure that people don't have to go through that because their basic eligibility probably didn't change, their financial circumstances wouldn't have changed, their mental health disabling condition probably didn't change, perhaps may have worsened. So this is just a way to prevent people from having to go through another step but prior to getting services.
We would have people who are severely mentally ill leaving the incarceration and then having a long wait before they could
back on medication.
Have their medications. Mm-hmm. Right.
Could lead to recidivism.
Okay. Thank you. Deanna or Heidi, either one of you going to answer this. I'm looking at the bill, and I know that this has been here for a long time, and I'm just curious about it. It deals with the description of what a person with a serious mental illness is. And then it goes into the description of what that is. On why would you tag it with a serious mental illness rather than just labeling it as mental illness? I'm thinking to myself, if it's serious, then it's a different level. So you might, for a description, and I'm looking at the description of what dementia, schizophrenia, bipolar. Wow. That seems to be what's out there right now.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson. The reason that we are very specific about having a severe mental illness is because those conditions most commonly and most often will meet the Social Security Administration's definition of disabling condition. It's also the definition we use when doing the presumptive Medicaid determination. So we know that these individuals are probably going to be able to be determined eligible relatively quickly and get their medical card. If you go down to the lesser severe mental illnesses, the amount of work to gather evidence to even take it to a disability determination may not result in an affirmative answer. So this group, we know we can move through quickly. It's also a small enough number that we didn't have to ask for additional staff to do it. One of the things we did talk about were the, I think there's a classification of 1, 2, and 3 in the corrections department, so we're dealing with the 3s. We might, over the next couple of years, look at what it might take to broaden that, maybe see what those individuals look like, how quickly we can make determinations of disability on their behalf.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you both very much. And I think we have Paul, whose last name I can't read. Sorry, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And my apologies, I scribble when I get this far into the legislative session. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 275. I think the witnesses who have already testified have explained it very well. I just wanted to share with the committee, in about 10 days or less, the May forecast is going to come out, and so will the co-chair's budget. And when those things occur, whatever current practice may exist is going to become more tentative in virtually every state agency, in my view. And so even though this happens to be a current practice, I think it's vitally important that it continue regardless, because frankly the fiscal and the emotional and the societal costs of doing otherwise are prohibitive. The reason why is when people get out of jails who are mentally ill, who are on medications that can stabilize them, and they lose access to those medications, the time lag that it takes under normal processes if they're not pre-qualified is more than enough time for them to get into trouble again, go back to jail again, go through the system again, reoffend, cause all kinds of problems, not only for themselves but for everybody else in the community as well. And the cost of that whole thing, I know in many cases up here I'm preaching to the choir, but it's got to be said, the costs of that are horrendous all the way around. And so for that reason especially, I think Senate Bill 275 is a very good idea, even though it's current practice. It took a while to get there. And during the period of time that it took to get there, there were lots of problems that occurred. I remember one community corrections manager saying, look, we'll use our staff. We'll pre-qualify them. If it's a resource issue for you guys, we'll do it. But we have got to have these folks so that they can transition from the institution to the street with the medications that they need to continue to be stable. That's all I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions here? All right. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275A. Colleagues, I intend to pass these bills, and we will have a work session coming up. And what I would like would be, if you have any questions about any of these, come to me. What the frown?
We're not ready today.
Well, I'd like to give people time. Sometimes I will be moving things quickly, okay. But if possible, unless there's some reason to move things on, I will probably, with most of the Senate bills, wait. There will come the time when I'm going to have to move things quickly, and I'd like to do that too. So if you see any problems with any of the bills that we're going to be hearing or any of these, I hope you would come to me so we can deal with that, because I think most of these are really good bills.
Yeah, I think I'm ready.
I'm ready, yeah. Yep.
Well, two people are absent.
No, that's fine, Madam Chair.
Yeah,
no, I just...
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No,
we're here
I'm
for
fine.
You.
Okay. We're here to support.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Support
and
defend.
Okay, and if there are problems, you're going to let me know, right? No surprises, right?
In which order?
Great. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Before you close, I just think, you know, everybody up here definitely gets it in a lot of these things, and usually the people out there get it. Can we just... run the world, and then if we could run the world,
yes.
Wouldn't it just be easier?
That's great. As long as I can be the chair.
You have to be the queen.
No.
Where do I sign up?
With that, I will close the public hearing. House Committee on Human Services.